Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. The Hasidic community in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn is famously one of the most separatist, intensely religious, and politically savvy groups of people in the entire United States. Less known is how the community survived in one of the toughest parts of New York City during an era of steep decline, only to later resist and also participate in the unprecedented gentrification of the neighborhood. In A Fortress in Brooklyn, Race, Real Estate, and the Making of Hasidic Williamsburg, published by Yale University Press in 2021, Nathaniel Deutsch and Michael Casper unravel the fascinating history of how a group of determined Holocaust survivors encountered, shaped, and sometimes fiercely opposed the urban processes that transformed their gritty neighborhood from white flight and the construction of public housing to rising crime, divestment of city services, and ultimately extreme gentrification. Nathaniel Deutsch is professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. I'm so glad his new book has brought him to our program. Welcome, Nathaniel.
Thank you so much, Salman.
So to begin with, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Well, answering the question about my background is pretty complicated, but I'll say that part of it that brought me to this work, that, let's say that's relevant for the book, is that I did have some experience and knowledge of Satmar and other Hasidic groups. The group that we focus on in the book is called Satmar, and it's connected to a town in what's now Romania, but previously was part of what's known as Greater Hungary. So Hungary used to be a lot bigger than it is now. And this is a town where this particular community that after World War II settled in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I had some knowledge, experience. In addition, and this was crucial for writing the book, in the 1990s, I moved to Williamsburg. And so I lived in Williamsburg from the 1990s until the end of until around 2008, 2009. And so while I was there, I became curious about the Hasidic part of the neighborhood. I didn't live in the Hasidic part. I lived in another part known as the North Side. And my co-author, Michael Casper, arrived also. I don't think he was living actually in Williamsburg, but very near Williamsburg in the 2000s. And we were put together by someone I think we knew in common. And initially, we're not going to write a book. We're going to write something shorter. But over a period of time, we realized that there was really an important story to be told in a number of ways, important in a number of ways, I should say. And we became very engrossed in the story and in researching it and spent over 10 years doing that research. And A Fortress in Brooklyn is the result of it.
Right. And you talk in the book about the parallels between the Puritan founders and the Satmars in Williamsburg. What are the possible connections between these two groups of people?
Yeah, so the book actually starts out with that comparison. And on the one hand, it seems like a very distant one, maybe even far-fetched. What could, Puritan Christians from England, hundreds of years ago have to do with Hasidim, who are members? Hasidism is a pietistic Jewish movement that originated in Eastern Europe in the 1700s has a relationship to the Kabbalah or Kabbalah, which is a form of Jewish mysticism, but also to other aspects of Eastern European Jewish culture and more broadly what we would call kind of early modern Jewish culture and society. And over time, it developed a charismatic leadership in which leaders were located in different towns throughout Eastern Europe with followers in their towns, but also in other communities where they would often go to visit, or their followers would come to their towns, their home bases to visit, and so on. What could those Eastern European pietistic Jews have in common with these Puritans from England? Well, for one thing, one could argue that from a history of religions point of view, they both participate in a kind of broader pietistic kind of phenomenon. The notion that one should create communities that live a more intensely religious lifestyle, you know, with charismatic leaders. In many of these communities, prophecy or some kind of prophetic voice was important. Often with ascetic practices, with different kinds of social norms that set them apart from the broader communities in which they were living. So in that sense, there are certain parallels, but in certain ways, even at least as importantly, is the idea that they came to the United States from elsewhere. And in the United States, or I shouldn't say the United States, in the Puritan case, of course, the United States didn't exist, but they came to North America, either in the colonial period or in the case of the Satmar Hasidim and the other Hungarian Hasidim that joined them in Williamsburg after World War II. And they tried to create new pietistic communities that were, on the one hand, in the world, whether it was colonial New England or in the case of the Hasidim in Brooklyn, but separate from the world at the same time, and trying to lead a kind of life that was not only a holy life for their community, but, and this is key, that could serve as a model for others. And ideally bring about some kind of larger redemption. And so I think that in all of those ways, there are these interesting parallels. One other thing I would say is that on the one hand, these are communities that are very almost otherworldly in their piety. But at the same time, if you look at the history of the Puritans and of Satmar, they're very practical and very savvy in some really fundamental ways that allow them to establish colonies, communities, and to thrive even as they are separatist and otherworldly in certain ways. So this interesting, the last thing I'll say, it's very interesting dynamic tension, and I would say power that comes from being, emphasizing holiness and practicality. And it seems like those two things should be at tension, and they are. But human beings are good at living with contradictions.
right. Well, that's really interesting. Speaking of historical comparisons, you contrast the immigration history of Hasidim in America with the better known story of Jewish immigration to America in the late 18, early 1900s. That was famously described by Irving Howe in his book, A World of Our Fathers. What are the key differences between these two waves of Jewish immigrants to America?
Right. So, history is the way that we describe in writing, typically, right, the past. And there's lots of different ways of describing the past. And there are narratives, there are stories that became popular about the past. And the most popular narrative or history of Jews in America tends to focus on the big waves of immigration that arrived beginning in the 1880s from Eastern Europe. It's not that there weren't Jews prior to that from the German-speaking lands or even Sephardi Jews from the Iberian Peninsula, but in terms of the numbers, in terms of their impact in all sorts of different ways, it was the waves of immigration from the Russian Empire, from Romania, and from the Austro-Hungarian Empire and actually also from the Ottoman Empire, much smaller numbers, but also around the same time, a little bit later, but they were very significant in establishing the Sephardi communities in the United States and some of the same places too, the Lower East Side of New York, the Bronx, and so on. So we have these Jews, and it's the Yiddish speaking Jews from Eastern Europe that are the, both in terms of their numbers and in terms of the attention from historians that really have gotten most of the focus, who arrive. Many of them came from Hasidic families, or they came from what's called Yeshivish families or Litvish families. That is, they weren't Hasidim, but they were also Orthodox or what's now called in English ultra-Orthodox families. But when they either before they leave or when they arrive in the U.S., they start a process of moving away from that kind of religiosity and getting interested in either in lots of political movements, including socialism, communism, Zionism, and so on, that often draw them away from that religiosity. Or they are just more interested in making a living. And maybe they do consider themselves, you know, if you had to press them, they might say, yeah, I'm traditional, but I only go to shul or synagogue once a year or a couple of times a year. They, like many immigrants in the same period, start to assimilate. They take on English. They're often made by the broader society, made to feel ashamed of their immigrant background and speaking Yiddish, for example. And over time, they, especially in the post-war period, they start to move into the suburbs and, for lack of a better term, Americanize. Although obviously now we think of that as in a much more complex way than they did back then. Now, the story of that we talk about in our book is a very, compared to that, a very underappreciated and undertold story. It has a different chronology. It has even different geography, and it involves different people. It involves people who, before World War II, primarily refused to leave Eastern Europe because they considered this country, that is the United States. I know there's people who are listening to this who aren't from the U.S., the United States, what's called a trefina medina in Yiddish, an impure, unkosher land that could actually contaminate religious Jews who set foot in it or certainly who lived in it. And so many of the Hasidim, the members of these pietistic Eastern European Jewish communities, did not come to the U.S. They stayed in Europe. Many of them were murdered, enslaved, and so on during the Holocaust. Small numbers of survivors start to come to the U.S. even during the war, but then after the war, they start to come in larger numbers, and they settle in Brooklyn. Among the neighborhoods they settle in is Williamsburg. And rather than Americanizing, meaning giving up the Yiddish, changing their dress, their behaviors, and so on to become more like other Americans, which at that time is primarily white, Christian, and so on, they double down on their difference. They double down on their difference. In fact, now, difference itself in Judaism going all the way back to the Torah or going all the way back to the Hebrew Bible is a very, very important thing. Okay. It's very difficult to understate that. So it's not as if they invented the notion that Jews should be different, but they emphasize that, and they emphasize that difference, rather than being a mark of shame, something you should be ashamed of, it's a sign of what's called Geon Yaakov in Hebrew, the pride of Jacob. That you should be proud of being Jewish, and that the differences can actually serve as a way of uniting you and strengthening you. And so this is a very different story. Now you might say, well, okay, it is very different in everything you've said. How, quote, relevant is it beyond that? And I would say very relevant in a number of ways. One is that demographically speaking, these are by far the fastest growing Jewish communities, not only in Brooklyn, not only in New York, but in the world. That is, communities like this who have that narrative that I've described. Not all of them are U.S. Some of them are in Canada, London, Antwerp, Buenos Aires, Israel, and so on. But many of them share these same kind of approaches and so on. And so that's just, I mean, I can talk more about it, but even if we just think in the most basic demographic terms, what will Judaism look like in the future? We will have to incorporate this narrative. And in the book, we focus on one slice of that narrative, the narrative that takes us to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where in fact, which becomes the headquarters of the largest Hasidic group in the world. It's very important for us, for anyone who wants to understand Judaism now and in the future, to understand this history, as well as this the other history of World of Our Fathers, which is also obviously very important as well.
Right. Speaking of Brooklyn, who was Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, and what was his attitude toward America after the Holocaust?
So Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, or as he was known to his followers, Rabbi Yoelish, he's the leader, the Rebbe. Rebbe is a term that's used in among Hasidic groups to refer to their leaders. So every community will have a Rebbe. And he was the leader of, became the leader of Satmar, of the Satmar Hasidic group. He became the leader in the early part of the 20th century. And he came from the most important Hungarian Hasidic family, dynasty. That's a term that's often used to describe the leadership within Hasidic communities, because it's often transmitted from father to son, or from older to a younger male relative, or to a disciple in some cases. Hungary was not the center of the Hasidic world in Eastern Europe. It was the more important leaders tended to come from Poland or White Russia or Ukraine, but he did come from the most important Hasidic family, the Teitelbaums in Hungary, and he himself already he distinguished himself for his learning, for his asceticism, and also for his political acumen already in Satmar, and his willingness to engage in struggles for power and authority, and his desire and his willingness to do that in order to create the kind of community that he thought was proper from a Jewish point of view already in Eastern Europe. He survives the Holocaust, it's a whole story in its own right, comes to the United States, to Brooklyn in 1946, and establishes, he comes from what was then Palestine. He was extremely anti-Zionist. He viewed Zion, he believed in the Kedusha, the holiness of the land of Israel. And he emphasized that. And he and his followers would talk about how much he loved the land of Israel and so on. But he believed, like the vast majority of Haredim, which is a Hebrew term that's often translated as ultra-Orthodox in English, that until the Mashiach, until the Messiah comes, Jews should not establish a nation state in the land of Israel. And therefore, he was opposed to it even before he arrived in the United States. He lived in Palestine very briefly after the Holocaust. And then, depending on who you talk to, there's different versions of why he left. But he comes to the United States, which apparently initially for what was supposed to be a brief period, but he decides to settle down in the U.S. Like other Haredim, and Hasidim are sort of become a branch of Haredim, but they're not really a branch of Haredim, but let's say under the umbrella of the Haredi movement, we might say. He initially views America, like his fellow Haredim, as a impure land that can contaminate you, but then he starts to see it as a place of opportunity. And even as the place where he will carry out his mission. And you could say ironically, or in Jewish mystical terms, it makes sense actually, and he and his followers would sometimes portray it in these terms, that it's precisely in the place that is the least holy, that is the most contaminated, that one has to go, that a certain individual who is what's called the Tzadik Ador, the holy man of his generation. Now, there were other Hasidic groups that thought that their leaders were also fit this role. And he was in competition with them, actually. One in particular, somebody called the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But both of these groups, Lubavitch, which establishes itself in Crown Heights, is another neighborhood in North Brooklyn, and Satmar, which establishes itself in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Both of them believe that their leaders have arrived in the United States in order to carry out a mission that ultimately will help lead to the redemption of the world and the arrival of the Messiah. So the U.S., the America becomes a place of possibility and a launching pad for the redemption.
Right, right. And speaking of Brooklyn and Brooklyn geography, you talk a lot of the book has to do with the racial dynamics between the white Hasidic members of the Satmar community in Williamsburg and their black and Latino neighbors. And you talk about how in some ways the Hasidim in Williamsburg were more similar to their black and Hispanic yes. neighbors than they were to the other middle-class Jews in the suburbs.
Yes.
Why was that the case? Or yes. in what ways was that the case?
So your question actually brings up two very, very important points. One is that, you know, you describe the Hasidim as white, and then you have the black and Hispanic neighbors. One of the things that the book tries to do is complicate the idea that the Hasidim, what does it mean for them to be white? And what does it mean over time? What is their relationship? I would say it's unclear whether they're white if we understand that category as a socially constructed category. It can mean different things also. It could be, do they see themselves as white? Are they seen by their neighbors? Are they do they experience the world the way that, let's say, whites in the suburb or even Jews in the suburb do in the same period? Or do they experience certain things in much more similar ways to, let's say, their black and Hispanic neighbors? Do they, how does the law treat them? You know, is there a single law? In the U.S., different groups are treated, in racial terms differently by different government agencies or by the Supreme Court in terms of certain decisions that are made, and so on. And things change over time. So the racialization, I would put it, of the Hasidim, which is a very important part of the book, turns out to be very complicated. Now, the second part, including their relationship to whiteness and including their relationship to the non-white communities. Alongside of whom they live in Williamsburg, which for most of the story that we look at in the post-war period, are the majority of their neighbors are Puerto Rican in the south side of Williamsburg, and then some African Americans across the border in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is another neighborhood in Brooklyn actually that sort of separates Williamsburg from Crown Heights, for example. It's large African-American community, as well as what are called in U.S. white ethnics. So people like Italian-Americans, Irish-Americans, so on. Though they tend to live in a different part or different parts of Williamsburg. Now, one of the things that we argue in the book is that in certain key ways, the experience of the Hasidim in Williamsburg, especially in the 60s and 70s, is more similar to their Puerto Rican and African-American neighbors than it is to the Jews, many of whom by that point are living in the suburbs. What do I mean? For example, many Hasidim move into high-rise public housing projects. In fact, they become the majority in a number of high-rise public housing projects in the early 1960s in Williamsburg, at a time when public housing in general, and especially high-rise public housing, was becoming associated in the popular imagination with racialized poverty. Meaning many whites moved out precisely in this period because they were ashamed of living in public housing because that was, quote, a place where poor blacks and Latinos lived. And if you were white and you could afford to or find a way out, you did. Hasidim, they are happy to move into public housing in Williamsburg. In fact, they, as it were, quote, move heaven and earth, as one source from that period said, to get into public housing. That's one thing. Another thing is that under Lyndon Johnson, who was the president of the United States in the mid-1960s, there were a number of social programs that are initiated to help poor people in the United States. The focus of those programs were either whites in Appalachia or African-Americans especially in the Northeast, cities like New York, Boston, et cetera, but then more broadly around the U.S., they were most definitely not Hasidim, living in places like Williamsburg or Crown Heights. However, Hasidim, once they become aware of the existence of these programs, develop a very potent and robust activist culture, which tapped into earlier Jewish traditions of communal activism, to benefit from these programs. The very same programs that their Black and Puerto Rican neighbors are benefiting from. And in fact, there's an intense competition for housing and those programs. In addition, Hasidim actively lobbied the U.S. government and the courts all the way up to the Supreme Court to have themselves be designated as a disadvantaged minority group. And in fact, end up being successful in one case with one government agency and they achieve that status under the Reagan administration. So there's a variety of ways, and I could go into more, but those are just three, in which Hasidim participate in, resemble, compete with their African-American and Latino neighbors in ways that really differentiate them from not only from Jews living in the suburbs. Of course, there are Jews who don't live in the suburbs, who live in the city, who are not, but many are leaving that period, but also, frankly, from other white or from white ethnics living in the same neighborhoods, such as Italians living in East Williamsburg and so on. The Hasidim are different from them as well in terms of living in public housing in these kinds of numbers, in terms of participating in these government programs that are often pejoratively described as welfare and so on. Even the activist class, that is much more similar to the kind of activist class that emerges, especially in African-American neighborhoods like Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant in this period. So it's quite fascinating. I'll just say one more thing that I think is very important, and people who spend time in Crown Heights or Williamsburg will note this or they have the opportunity to note it. Maybe they don't notice it, but they should, which is that just the kind of being in the world, the urban, just we described in the book, a kind of urban swagger, a comfort being in the city, which of course Jews historically in the modern period were very urban people in general and were urbanized at earlier and greater rates. That's something that Hasidim retained, a kind of comfort. And you see that in speech patterns. You see that in occupying space. You see that in a whole variety of ways that they're much more similar to their neighbors, non-Jewish neighbors, than to anyone living in the suburbs.
Really, really interesting. Given what you were just describing in terms of the competition between the Satmar and other Hasidim in Williamsburg, between them and their non-Jewish, some of their non-Jewish neighbors, what was the relationship between the Hasidim of Williamsburg and their Black or Hispanic neighbors in the early decades after World War II?
Yeah. So
early decades of the community there.
Right. Great question. So as I mentioned, you know, there are a number of neighborhoods. I mentioned Crown Heights in Williamsburg. There was also Borough Park, where another neighborhood in central Brooklyn, where a lot of Hasidim from a variety of different places in Crown Heights. There were Lubavitchers although there were some other groups that also lived there, but eventually left and Lubavitch stayed. In Borough Park, they have multiple groups. And in each of these places, the non-Jews who live there come from different backgrounds. In Borough Park, there are more Italians, for example. In Crown Heights, it's Caribbean Americans and African Americans. In Williamsburg, it was mainly Puerto Rican, again, with some African Americans on the border. And then on the other side, there were some Italians and Poles and others, other white ethnics. But in South Williamsburg, which is where the Hasidic community is really centered, the main neighbors are Puerto Ricans. They're arriving at roughly the same time in large numbers in Williamsburg and elsewhere in Brooklyn. That's one of the big stories of, you know, the second half of the 20th century in New York is the growth of the Puerto Rican community. Very vibrant community, Williamsburg is one of the centers of Puerto Rican life in the city. And so the first part of our book really traces the kind of parallel development of these communities and their interactions. And people who live in urban neighborhoods that are shared by multiple groups that are working class and poor, okay, I think will appreciate that often the interactions are kind of live and let live. You can live parallel lives. Some spaces tend to be dominated by one group or another. In other times, they're shared, and then there's conflict when the resources, especially during periods of where resources are hard to come by. So all of that stuff happened, meaning there were some playgrounds that, you know, oh, at this time of day, Hasidic mothers and their children will be there. Oh, at this time of day, Puerto Rican mothers and their children, different times, maybe this part of the playground will be used by one group, part of the other. We go to this store, they go to the other store, da-da-da-da-da. At the same time, though, when it came to basic necessities, the 1960s and 1970s were a time of incredible resource deprivation, even what was called planned shrinkage in New York, meaning that as the budget of New York City got worse and worse, and the tax base got smaller and smaller, there were voices within the city government to allow some neighborhoods to basically shrink as a result, and to do that by restricting resources to them, by not investing as many resources. What did that mean in practice? It meant things like housing, it meant policing, it meant public services, garbage collection, all these kinds of things. Williamsburg was one of those neighborhoods. It was at one point, I think, the sixth poorest neighborhood in New York. It had the most gangs in, and crime was rising at the same time, not unconnected, of course, to the constriction of resources and a whole bunch of other things. And so in this environment, it became what one scholar has called street fighting pluralism, meaning you had to fight for resources. And often it was seen as a zero-sum game. Hasidim engaged in that with their neighbors, but they were not alone in that. In fact, some of the most intense fighting went on between Puerto Ricans and Blacks in not only in Brooklyn, but especially in northern Manhattan and in the Bronx, between activists for those groups who would get access to these government funds. And Hasidim do the same. And they also participate in another aspect of this, which is that different groups understand certain blocks as being their turf. And the Hasidim in Williamsburg, after initially experiencing, suffering from the broader crime wave that, kind of engulfs New York City in that time, and you see a lot of in the Hasidic press, one of the things we do in the book is look at a lot of newspaper articles from this whole period, meaning from the 1940s up to the present, more or less. And you see in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of the Hasidim saying, like in their newspapers, they published at that time a one Yiddish newspaper called Der Yid, the Jew in English, in Yiddish. And they say, like, you know, what are the police going to do? Like, there's all this crime going on. You know, the police don't seem to be here. This was also a time when the police was being rocked with a lot of scandals. And eventually they decide to take matters into their own hands and to respond, actually, like a lot of different communities in New York, including the African-American one in Fort Greene, which is a neighborhood near Williamsburg, by creating community kind of patrol groups, or by spontaneously responding when a crime occurs or a suspected crime by yelling in Yiddish, "Chapsim, grab him," and people would run out of their houses and grab the suspect and apprehend them and sometimes beat them up, which of course led to charges of vigilantism by their neighbors and to a great deal of tension. They said that they were defending themselves. If we look at it from a kind of sociological point of view, we might say that they were in this other way, in yet another way, participating in the broader kind of cultural norms of the neighborhood, which if you look at New York City and Brooklyn, especially in that period, people were in this time of retrenchment of government resources, they would often, as they put it, take the law into their own hands. And the Hasidim do that. It surprised a lot of people because there were a lot of stereotypes about Jews and religious Jews in particular, that they, some of them connected to the Holocaust, but many of them going back far further, that they were, quote, passive, and that they would not be violent. But in fact, we see with not only Satmar, but other Hasidic groups too, a willingness to defend themselves, even up to and including engaging in behaviors that were understood as vigilantism by others.
Right. And how did the police respond to Hasidic efforts at self-protection?
The police were in a difficult situation. It was difficult for them because they were sensitive to the claims of both communities. And both communities had different kinds of political and power and claims, especially during the Lindsay administration, which was a liberal administration. Mayoral John Lindsay was the mayor of New York and for much of the 60s. And he had been elected through a coalition of African-Americans and progressive whites, many of them Jewish. The Hasidim did not fall into either of those categories. So on the one hand, and there was also a period of awareness there had been various riots or uprisings, depending on how one sees them, right, against in major cities around the U.S., including in New York City in that period, the mid and late 60s. The civil rights movement was very active. There were these government programs. So all of that is to say that the kinds of, and this was a period also where housing discrimination, civil rights legislation was being passed to prohibit housing discrimination, all sorts of various forms of discrimination. So on the one hand, you have these kinds of claims and the kind of political, if not power, then at the very least, claims that you can have from the African American and the Puerto Rican community. Although I don't want to lump those two together because they actually have very different histories, characters, trajectories, and so on. So, and in certain ways, the very much the early 70s was a period where the Puerto Rican community in Williamsburg starts to get a political voice for the first time in a significant way, which also can bring them into conflict with Hasidim over things like the school, using schools and school spaces and housing and playgrounds and so on. But the politics is such that the Hasidim, they see the crime actually, and we see this over and over, through the lens of the Holocaust and through the long centuries of violence against Jews in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. So they make claims on the police and say, you not only do you need to address the violence that's being directed against members of our community, but this is something that we've been experiencing for centuries. And by the way, we're suspicious of you, i.e. the police, because where we came from in different parts of Europe, the police were not sympathetic to the Jews and actually were often part of the structure that discriminated against the Jews. So you have two communities that are suspicious of the police, think that the police are favoring the other for different reasons. Because often the Puerto Rican and African American residents of Williamsburg or the bordering neighborhoods will say, well, you're favoring the Hasidim as Jews and as whites. And the Hasidim will say, well, you're showing favoritism to these other groups because they are benefiting from all of these government programs and civil rights is in the air and so on. And they're non-Jews. And we have there's a long history of, you know, they see it through the lens of anti-Semitism. So it's this fascinating thing where these different communities that all have histories of discrimination against them, that all have these claims against the other that are suspicious of the police. And then you have the police who are trying to satisfy these different constituencies. Maybe it's Mayor Lindsay saying certain things from top down, but then you've got the local people who are making different claims. So we see from that period, I know it's a long answer, but hopefully that the complexity of it is there. It's one last thing, which is that there are Jewish police in Williamsburg that are assigned to Williamsburg. They're not Hasidic Jews there are accounts from that period where they'll say it's more difficult for us to be Jewish police in a Jewish neighborhood, especially in a Hasidic neighborhood, than it would be for us to be police elsewhere. Presumably because that kind of same on the one hand, but other on the other hand, created a lot of situations on the ground where maybe the Hasidim treated them differently because they were Jewish, the police, and maybe the police treated the Hasidim. Sometimes there's at least some evidence that they may have treated the Hasidim more harshly because they were Jewish, but Jewish in a way that these police, in some cases at least, felt embarrassed about or antagonistic towards. Anyway, it's a very important question, one that's really complicated.
I will just mention that I think your answer to my last question is really indicative of the style of your book, in the sense that you don't satisfy yourself with simple answers, that your book covers a lot of complex history and history that a lot of people think they know about or assume that there's obvious answers to whatever is being discussed. And your book does a really wonderful job at digging really deep and showing that these issues are much, much more complex than might first be imagined. And you try to unravel a lot of that complexity.
Thank you.
Yeah. So speaking of complexity, so your book, the first portion of your book describes essentially the arrival of the Satmar community, the Satmar Rebbe and his followers in Williamsburg, and how they build up their community in that location, and their attempts to try to access public funding for housing and other things. And then you continue the story to when Williamsburg itself goes through major transformations with the process of gentrification. So first of all, when did the gentrification begin in Williamsburg, and what was the demographic of the first wave of gentrifiers in that neighborhood?
So gentrification really begins in the 1980s. It kicks in more strongly in the 1990s. Until the 1980s and even into the 1990s, a majority of people living in Williamsburg, whether they're Hasidic or Puerto Rican or African-American or Polish or whatever, are working class. There are poor people too, you know, many of them concentrated in public housing, which has an income, you know, requirement. You know, it's a very industrial neighborhood. It's one of the most industrial neighborhoods on the water. It's located, for those who may not know, it's on the East River. It's on the waterfront. And so like a lot of waterfront areas, becomes the site of a lot of industrial activity. It had a lot of famous factories, Domino Sugar Plant, a whole bunch of other factories. So a guitar factory. So the arrival of it, and it's located right across the Williamsburg Bridge from Lower Manhattan and the financial center of New York City and arguably the world. So it's got good location, and yeah, to say the least. And already in the 60s, 70s, you started to see the gentrification of parts of Lower Manhattan, famously Soho, which becomes a big center for artists and art galleries, and then the East Village. And people start getting priced out of there. They start going over the Williamsburg Bridge, just as, you know, a century earlier, less than a century earlier, Jews had left the Lower East Side because of overcrowding there to come to Williamsburg. This was before the Hasidim arrived. Williamsburg, I didn't mention this, but Williamsburg had a very, very large Jewish community even before the Hasidim started arriving after World War II. And so the first people who come over are often artists or aspiring artists from places like the East Village and Soho, and they settle in warehouse and loft spaces that were formerly industrial or may even be continuance. Parts of the building may continue to house some industry in the 1980s, let's say, but part of it is carved out for living space. Now, this is where the Hasidim kind of re-enter the story in another way, because many of those buildings in the part of Williamsburg that became gentrified for the parts of Williamsburg, which were the part along the waterfront and then a part of Williamsburg called North Williamsburg, were Hasidim didn't live in those parts, but they owned property in those parts. In many cases, they had bought buildings, either warehouses or garment factories, because this was a site of a lot of the garment industry in New York, from other Jews. When those Jews left the neighborhood, they would sell the buildings to the Hasidim. In some cases, they were partners with other Jews who, you know, there were other Jews who remained. They did, maybe they lived in, you know, Westchester, which is a suburb of New York, but they still can maintain business in Williamsburg. Those Hasidim then become the landlords for this first wave of gentrifiers. And it remains that way for a number of years. Very early on, Hasidim in Williamsburg, they don't really have a sense of what this is all going to mean, because it's happening outside of their enclave. And it's really something that's known only to those Hasidim, those individual Hasidim that happen to own property and suddenly realize they can rent out or lease out some of their property to these newcomers. In the 1990s, this kicks in a big way. And many developers and real estate brokers, as well as people, most of whom are no longer artists, but people who are attracted to a certain lifestyle that comes along with artists often, cafes, bars, music scene, etc., start arriving in Williamsburg. And so that's really this, I would say the second wave is really in the 1990s. Already then, the prices in Williamsburg, broadly speaking, start going up and start affecting even the Hasidic part, which is often accompanied by gentrification. That is, real estate prices tend to go up, not only in the neighborhood itself, but even in adjacent areas. And then those adjacent areas, which have lower prices in terms of buying and renting, there's what's called a rent gap. That is, that there's a gap in between the prices in the gentrified neighborhood and the adjoining neighborhood, and soon spills out over into the adjoining neighborhood. So now we start seeing different parts of Williamsburg getting gentrified, as well as adjoining neighborhoods, like Greenpoint, for example. Eventually, by the end of the 1990s, the gentrification starts to affect a part of Williamsburg that was primarily Latino, by then Dominican and Puerto Rican, which borders the Hasidic part of Williamsburg. And once that happens, and it arrives at a street called Broadway, not the Broadway in Manhattan, but the Brooklyn Broadway, Hasidim start getting nervous that gentrification is not only going to affect their real estate prices, but gentrifiers themselves are actually going to start competing for housing in their part of the neighborhood, and also that they're going to start influencing by their presence the life in the neighborhood, and especially be a negative influence in a cultural sense on the young people and children in their community.
All right. And so how does the Hasidic community of Williamsburg respond to what they perceive as this external threat to their the integrity of their community?
So in a way, it might seem counterintuitive to some, but for most of the history of Hasidic Williamsburg, which preceded gentrification, although there was competition with their Puerto Rican and African American neighbors over resources, and although there was tension between, let's say, Hasidim accusing or experiencing, in fact, street crime from some African Americans and some Puerto Ricans, and in turn, some members of the Puerto Rican and African American community accusing Hasidim of vigilantism, so on. In general, they sort of had a live and let live attitude towards one another and shared the neighborhood. There were ups and downs, etc. There was even a notable moment when they allied with one another to fight. The city was going to place a giant garbage incinerator in the neighborhood, and Puerto Rican and Black and Hasidic activists worked together to fight the city for ultimately successfully so that they wouldn't do that. The Hasidim did not view their neighbors prior to gentrification as an existential threat, despite whatever conflict and competition. But Hasidim did view, many of them at least, view the new gentrifiers as an existential threat to their community. That it might be impossible for Hasidim to continue living in Williamsburg if gentrification transformed the neighborhood in two ways. One, the finances, the money, that it became, this was also a period when the Hasidic community had grown tremendously from a few hundred families to tens of thousands of people, and they needed places to live. And they needed places to live because of their way of life, that they had to walk to the synagogue, that they had to have certain stores that sold meat that was kosher, and other supplies that had to be prepared in certain ways according to the rules and regulations of their community and the religious leaders in the community. And they felt really rooted in the community, that this was the place that these Holocaust survivors who had founded the community, who had arrived with nothing, who had established a Kehila Kedosha, a holy community in this place. So they were very attached to it in a variety of ways. And yet, if you have 10 children and each of them ultimately needs a place to live with their families, where can you find that when all the housing around it is going up dramatically in cost? And it's already saturated within your enclave. So that was the first thing. But the second thing, and equally important, was the idea that the gentrifiers, who were primarily white, not all of them, of course, but white, upper middle class or middle class, at least seemingly secular, that they actually posed a moral threat, a much greater moral threat than any of the neighbors previously did. And that, in fact, they represented, in part because of their race and in part because of their class, a kind of lifestyle that younger Hasidim especially might find appealing. And that over time, especially as it coincided with other changes going on in the Hasidic community in Williamsburg as well as elsewhere, the introduction of the internet, what we call in the book the embourgeoisement of the neighborhood, of the community, meaning that even though there were still many, many poor Hasidim, there were a growing number of Hasidim, especially those involved in the real estate industry, not coincidentally, who had more money to spend, that they might lose their attachment to Hasidic way of life, which in Satmar in particular had always been anti-materialistic in its ideology, had seen luxury as a moral defect, at least in theory. In practice, there was always, struggle over that. But in theory, and certainly that was what Rabbi Yoelis, their leader, would emphasize. And now, gentrification, along with everything else, brought a kind of conspicuous consumption that I would say, in terms of the threat, was even seen as probably greater in certain ways than the financial one. And so some activists within the community in the early 2000s waged what they called Milchemes Artistin, the war against the artists, because artist or artiste was how they described the gentrifier. They didn't use the term gentrifier, then they would say artists, basically, to refer to everyone, even though by that point, a lot of the gentrifiers were investment bankers or media, people who worked in media or students or whatever. But anyway, and they tried to prevent members of their community from selling or renting to gentrifiers, with some success, but definitely not complete success ultimately.
Right, right. And how is the tragedy of 9/11 employed in the war against the artists?
So one of the interesting things was that in the war against the artists was that it coincided roughly, right, it's just a few years after 9/11, the attack on the World Trade Center, in particular, which was right across the East River. So from Williamsburg, you can see very easily, right? It's very close to what happened. So people witnessed that and experienced the aftermath. And Hasidim already had, not only Hasidim, but traditionally, there's a Jewish tradition of seeing current catastrophes or crises through the lens of past ones, going all the way back to what's called Churban Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, or the two temples in Jerusalem. That's a kind of archetypal or paradigmatic catastrophe that gets kind of re-experienced in different generations. So in this case, they saw the gentrification and the threat of gentrification not through the lens of the destruction of the World Trade Centers, but also, as it turns out, through the destruction of through the lens of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, that is, of the Temple in Jerusalem, and other catastrophes that had happened over the centuries to Jewish communities. And in all of those cases, they pointed out, when I say they pointed out, there were demonstrations, there were broadsides that were posted on walls. It's a very common thing to do in Hasidic neighborhoods or Haredi neighborhoods around the world. You put a broadside where you say, you know, people, listen, this is happening, we need to take action, etc., as well as in the newspapers, where they said this was due to a lack of piety, that their own, within the community, people weren't following the kind of keeping the holiness that their previous generations had. Also a very common view that previous generations are more holy than the current ones. And secondly, that there were basically kind of collaborators within the community, that there were some members of the community that were willing to, as they put it, sell out their community for the sake of money. And that the solution was for people to double down on holiness and condemn the collaborators as they understood them and prevent them from participating in the community by threatening them with things like, if you sell to gentrifiers, we are going to prevent your kids and grandkids from going to our community schools, for example.
Right. Wow. Very, very kind of harsh measures to try to stem this tide of gentrification. All right. A last question. What ways has gentrification changed Hasidic Williamsburg, and what ways has it not?
Yes. So one of the ways that gentrification has most dramatically changed it is that, it's part of the gentrification story, I would say, is that Hasidim themselves engaged in an expansion of the neighborhood. They expanded the neighborhood into parts of Brooklyn that were previously not Hasidic, not part of their enclave, that are parts of Bedford Stuyvesant, Clinton, and Clinton Hill, which are neighborhoods that historically have bordered Williamsburg, which had large African American Latino populations, or in the parts that the Hasidim expanded into that were more industrial and had commercial rather than residential real estate. And they did that by buying up properties in those areas and redeveloping them. Now, are they gentrifiers in those cases or not? Is a really interesting question, and one that's, like a lot of the questions that are asked and explored in this book, you know, it's complex because, if, you know, on the one hand, there's a lot of real estate development going on. Some of the real estate development that's going on is for, you know, pretty expensive condominiums. But it's also the case that many of the Hasidim that move into what becomes known as New Williamsburg receive Section 8, which is a government subsidized. At a certain point, the federal government more or less got out of building new housing projects and instead gave people who would otherwise qualify for public housing vouchers to be used to subsidize their rents. In addition, Hasidim had a long presence in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Jews in general did, Hasidim did, so they're not coming from, you know, outside of the neighborhood in the same way. So that's one aspect of this that continues to be to unfold, because the New Williamsburg has expanded dramatically. It's one of the most dramatic neighborhood transformations in New York since the white flight of the 1960s. But most people in the city don't even know that it's happened, unless you go to that part of Bedford-Stuyvesant. So that's one thing. At the same time, Williamsburg, what's now called Old Williamsburg by some, is really ringed by not only the kind of gentrification that took place in the 1980s and 90s, which was relatively small scale, but increasingly by very large scale luxury developments, especially along the waterfront, in buildings that in many cases had been owned by Hasidim and were used for industrial purposes, have now been bought by some of the biggest real estate developers in the city and in some cases internationally, whether it's the Netherlands, China, etc. So international money is now coming in and developing parts of Williamsburg that just a few decades ago were literally, there were places that where people were applying this, you know, the sex trade, where drugs were being dealt, where the amount of money paid for square footage was, you know, unbelievably low compared to what it became. And so it's ringed by that. But if you go into Old Williamsburg itself, it almost has, especially compared to what's going around it, including in New Williamsburg, it has like a almost like a old fashioned, I don't know how to describe it exactly, like a quaint, you know, feel to it. Because it's so much calmer and quieter than everything going on around it, that it's changed too, though. I shouldn't say that, don't get the impression it hasn't changed, because even within the, you'll now find health food stores, and you'll find on the main Lee Avenue, which is the main business district, you'll find new stores that have new signs. Some businesses are like 50 years old and they have new signs that look like, you know, more chic kind of, or shishi kind of businesses you'd find elsewhere. So they've also been influenced, but on the side streets, you can still get a taste of, you know, the kind of the more old school Williamsburg, I would say.
Right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you very much, Solomon. I appreciate it. And thank you, listeners.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.